glory, but wisdom is immune to our humanity and tendency to fall short. Let's dissect the reason why I fail at this sometimes, and in doing so, I think I will reveal some lessons in how to toughen up. It comes down to emotion. In public, you will have a hard time getting me to react emotionally, especially with politics. But there are people who do have an ability to get me agitated, and those are usually the people I am close with, or the ones who are on my team. Why is that? Maybe it is because there is a sense that they know you best, and their observation or criticism is painfully accurate. Or maybe it's the opposite. Their critique or observation is terribly inaccurate, and you feel they should know better. It depends on the situation, I think. The point is that it is worth thinking about. I have had to analyze why I overreacted in a deep and honest way, and then apply it to my future wargaming. It can help you be still during the next round of emotional agitation you are sure to encounter. Frankly, I should do it more often. Wargaming doesn't just apply to, well, war. It applies to life. As I stated earlier, wargaming is just the simple mental act of imagining a scenario. It is the practice of mentally walking through various scenarios and then imagining your ideal reactions to those scenarios. In training and in combat, we are wargaming constantly. If this happens, how should I react? What if, during our patrol, we began taking fire from our left flank? What call would I make? What cover should we maneuver to? So when it does happen, you've already thought through the action and it comes with ease. You are better prepared. Your mind is freed to embrace new, unexpected challenges. And in a firefight with the enemy, those new and unexpected challenges will come up fast. Better to consciously prepare for that which can be anticipated and be mentally prepared to deal with that which cannot. I wargame constantly, mostly with respect to political debate. It happens to be my job and my passion, so it comes naturally. My wife will catch me talking to myself in the living room and then ask, "Hey babe, who are you debating?" She has become accustomed to this strange habit of mine. Anyone who has ever practiced for anything, sports, debate, a biology test, is familiar with that particular idiosyncrasy. I am simply encouraging you to do it more often as it relates to confrontational and uncomfortable situations. Imagine how you want to be seen reacting to a difficult situation, and simply think about reacting that way. You'll be amazed at the effects. Soldiers certainly know the benefits. In training, it is sometimes lost on us why we train using the drills that we do. They may seem redundant, boring, or unrealistic, or any number of descriptions. But then, the real thing happens. In the real world, the bomb goes off. The bullets start flying, the truck rolls over, the radio breaks. You're stressed and mostly unable to calmly rationalize or problem solve. And yet, you solve the problem. Why? Because you've thought about it before. Wargaming simply means you have bothered to think about it before. You have played the what-if game, and you have won. Now, let's apply this to the most emotionally taxing and divisive category in our lives today. Politics. In our political disagreements today, our emotional attachment to certain positions has taken on new extremes. Whether or not this is something new is anyone's guess, but it certainly seems more intense than ever before because of the loudspeaker that social media provides to everyone's opinion. In his book, The Smallest Minority, Kevin Williamson writes, "This exudate of outrage and dread has arrived together with the rise to prominence of social media and other instruments of communication that not only are better suited for emotional outbursts than for reasoned discussion, but which, as a consequence of their basic social architecture, reward rage, extremism, and hostility while they suffocate intelligence, charity, and gentleness." The likelihood of anyone saying, "Oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. Thank you for clarifying your position," during a debate in the depths of Facebook comments is laughably small. It is even more unlikely in the 280 character limit depths of Twitter. But the real reason it is unlikely isn't because of social media. It is because it is human nature to dig in and double down. Your gut tells you to never back down from a position that you are emotionally invested in. Politics has become a team sport, and that makes it extremely difficult to swallow your pride and admit error. I speak at a lot of high schools. One question that I am inevitably asked is, how should we get more involved in politics? My answer is always the same. Take it slow. Don't choose a side. Just keep learning and take pride in having an open mind. Your opinions on complex matters should come to you slowly, over time, within the context of new facts and experiences. Most adults simply haven't had access to all of the information yet, let alone most teenagers. Your experiences are few, and your knowledge of any given subject incomplete, and that's okay. There is nothing wrong with not knowing, but there is something deeply wrong about having a strong opinion based on very little fact or reason. A cautious approach to opinion formation is also better for your mental health. Discovering you were wrong about a subject is psychologically taxing, especially after investing serious emotional energy into that opinion. The first reaction is often to dig in, stay wrong, and get angry. By emotionally attaching yourself to an opinion so early in life, you've set yourself up to be the person you never wanted to be, outraged. I view this tendency toward extreme emotional attachment to an argument as both a societal problem and an indication of mental weakness. A mentally tough, confident person does not have a problem admitting they are wrong or unknowledgeable on a subject. A weaker person, captive to emotions and unsure of themselves, does. This is the hard truth. And the next hard truth? Many of us are in the latter category. And if we aren't fully in the latter category, we have certainly dabbled in it. This is partly because our hero archetype architecture is miscalibrated. As I've said earlier, we elevate the public figures that exude the most passion instead of the most sense. Passion becomes synonymous with authenticity and gives the loudmouthed activist or politician an undue amount of credibility on an issue, even when completely wrong. As people admire these fist-shaking, quote-unquote, leaders, they themselves are more likely to behave in the exact same way. When confronted with a disagreement, their likeliest reaction is to raise their voice and hurl insults. We see this all the time in our political discourse, and it's ripping the country apart. We have chosen the wrong heroes and the wrong character attributes to elevate and value. We need a sharp recalibration in what we view as good. So how do we fix it? How do we dabble more often in the first category of cool, calm, and collected? What do wargaming, mental preparedness, stillness, and stoicism have to do with the goal of political detoxification? We can apply these lessons, tried and tested from the battlefield, to the way we absorb the news, interpret a friend's comment on Twitter, or hear a provocative speaker on a college campus. Wargaming, in this context, is applied as imagining a scenario in which you don't freak out on someone else. What a concept. Maintaining your stillness is about stopping for a second and asking a question, preferably a good, constructive question that will elicit some form of truth. This is quite easy to practice, and I would certainly encourage you to do so. The news headlines are a great place to start. In the 21st century news cycle, where shocking headlines get more clicks, the incentive to write provocative headlines at the expense of truth and context is terribly strong. Words like bombshell, corrupt, traitor, and treason elicit an immediate sense that the story is deadly serious, begging you to read more into it. As author Matt Taibbi notes in his book Hate Inc., content is designed not just to be lurid and sensational, but immediately disquieting from a psychological standpoint. The media's goal is to literally challenge your ability to be still. A tough American, intent on improving upon their current self, is not tricked into an emotional reaction by these headlines. You do not write an angry tweet. You do not hurl an insult. You are cool and measured and skeptical. You are curious what the agenda of the journalist might be and what facts or context they might be leaving out. You seek out a different story on the same topic from an opposing view, and you find out that many of the claims made in the original story were convincingly debunked. And just like that, you're a Zen master of stillness and stoicism. A part of curing our political debate is having the courage to stand up for what you know and admit what you don't know. And when you do stand up for what you know, you better damn well know why you believe it. And just because you believe it doesn't therefore mean you should express your belief in the most emotional of ways. If you do, it may indicate that you are filling in your knowledge gaps with raw passion and hoping that no one will realize it. Unfortunately, these days, too many people are overcoming their knowledge deficits with passion, and too many more people are mistaking passion and authenticity for righteousness and sophistication. It is an unhealthy trend. I find this dearth of curiosity to be especially bad with many policy debates. Take regulations, for instance. When you hear, "President Trump repeals 12 more Obama-era environmental regulations," what goes through your head? If you're being honest, probably images of fat-cap businessmen celebrating as they dump sludge into a pristine river, or some kind of ooze seeping into a green field, or dark black smoke suddenly emanating from a factory as birds fall out of the sky, choking. Why not ask a few questions first? Why were the regulations put in only during the previous administration? Was there really a need for them in the first place? What was the cost-benefit analysis done? Or start with a more basic question. What kind of regulations were these? Let's take one recent example. In August of 2019, The Hill ran a story on the Trump administration EPA's proposed rule changes to the new source review regulations under the Clean Air Act. The headline read, "EPA proposes easing air pollution permitting process." This headline clearly implies a particular message. More air pollution is coming from power plants. But is it? In this particular case, and in many cases like it, the story itself is actually somewhat balanced. The author notes what the EPA's argument is, which is current regulations actually discourage more efficient technology being installed, and this new reform will actually remove obstacles to the construction of cleaner and more efficient facilities. And they note the environmentalists' arguments. They believe net pollution will increase. But most people don't dig through the content of the story, and instead simply read the headline. And in this case, like so many others, the heavily editorialized headline gives the wrong impression. The reality of this particular policy issue goes much deeper, which is what all fair-minded and mentally tough Americans should do: dig a little deeper. New Source Review, or NSR, is a permitting process that is required by the Clean Air Act and impacts virtually every major manufacturing facility and power plant in the United States. Put simply, if you are a new power plant or factory, you have to get a permit from the EPA to make sure your new plant is not going to adversely affect the surrounding air quality. Seems fair enough, since we all have an interest in cleaner air. But as most regulations do, this one has gotten out of control. The NSR process oftentimes costs companies millions of dollars, years of delays, and uncertainty, as companies don't always know what will trigger an NSR by the EPA. It begs the question, is this regulation really keeping our air cleaner? As currently written, this regulation has prevented the very thing it's advocating for, cleaner air, because NSR also kicks in for major modifications, like adding a carbon capture facility to a power plant. It impedes companies from investing in even cleaner air quality. Take Petranova, a carbon capture pilot program in the greater Houston area. Petranova and its parent company, NRG Energy, have had incredible success with their carbon capture project. By capturing 5,000 tons of carbon dioxide per day, they've taken the equivalent of 350,000 cars off the road, generated power for thousands of homes in Houston, and recycled the carbon that would have been otherwise released into the atmosphere. But when they were building their plant, they had a decision to make. Would they trigger the costly NSR by modifying their existing power plants, or spend $100 million to create a completely new system and thus bypass NSR? They chose to spend the $100 million. An incredibly costly way to avoid the even costlier expense of triggering NSR to decrease their carbon dioxide emissions. The EPA's new rules would change this incentive for the better by changing the criteria that trigger NSR to encourage carbon capture investment by both the manufacturing and energy industries. If your project decreases the overall amount of pollutants rather than increases, the project will not be subject to NSR. It's an elimination of a regulation for the sake of better regulation, and one that actually helps achieve the goal of cleaner air. The Hill's headline missed all of that context, and their story barely scratched the surface of the issue. If you are predisposed to think that Trump and Republicans are anti-environment, then that headline was all you needed to confirm that bias. But more context changes the story substantially. These days, there is so little space to wonder why, in good faith, someone might be making the decision they are making. Just because we all agree on having oil and gas regulations does not therefore mean that any and all of the regulations make sense. Imagine if that were the case. All a regulatory agency would have to do is simply say, well, it makes the air cleaner, and we must line up blindly behind them or be bullied into submission. That's absurd, of course. Many regulations have been feel-good measures that have a marginal positive impact on the environment, but enormous costs. It also ignores the important question of what other preventive measures might be taken aside from top-down, one-size-fits-all regulations. No one disagrees with smart regulations, especially on the environment. But to pretend that all regulations are good, or even necessary, is an analytical leap that is based on emotional reasoning and not careful analysis. It is also indicative of a society that is losing the ability to assume good intentions about people on the opposite political team, and has a lazy tendency to judge without evidence. The media's grotesque behavior only worsens this trend. Remember the angry veterans that confronted me outside my office? Shortly after that incident, they colluded with Newsweek, the former news magazine turned left-wing tabloid, to write a blatantly misleading headline: Crenshaw tries to hide in elevator while confronted by combat veterans. The false headline is easily debunked by simply watching the video embedded in the article. I wasn't hiding at all. I was on my way to vote, and the elevator is simply part of that journey. The crazed young men entered the elevator with me. The writers knew this, of course, but wanted to write a salacious headline at the expense of factual reporting. A still person has the ability to stop, look at a news story or another person's arguments, and ask objective questions without emotional overreaction or assumptions of ill intent. One is centered, rational, and respected. The other is frantic, unhappy, and intellectually stagnant. Don't be the latter. Because of this reality, I have gotten into the habit of explaining controversial votes or issues with videos on social media. I call them "Here's the Truth" videos because, well, I feel there has usually been some dishonest narrative put forth about what the legislation in question was really about. One particularly egregious example was H.R. 986, the Protecting Americans with Pre-Existing Conditions Act. I voted against it. Why? Because I don't want to protect people with pre-existing conditions? Of course not. I voted against it because that particular bill had nothing to do with protecting people with pre-existing conditions. At the height of political dishonesty, Democrats crafted a bill that would have removed the recently expanded ability of states to use different methods to insure people. Some states, for instance, have seen huge success by using reinsurance programs to protect people with pre-existing conditions, while also not forcing those additional costs on the healthy population's insurance premium costs. They do this by using a 1332 waiver within the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. The bill in question would have actually made these waivers less flexible and therefore made it more difficult to experiment with different options. So not only did this bill not protect people with pre-existing conditions, it actually limited our options to protect people with pre-existing conditions. Knowing that Republicans would vote against it, the Democrats slyly named the bill Protecting Americans with Pre-Existing Conditions so that they could use it as a campaign commercial in 2020. Why would they do this? Because they know they can take advantage of a population that jumps to conclusions and doesn't engage in a be-still mentality. And they aren't the only ones. We see this daily, on the left and the right. where a single social media post will send users into a confirmation bias-driven frenzy. Fake news stories, literally fake news, not the intentionally biased mainstream media headlines I noted earlier, that sensationalized preconceived notions of a given issue are a surefire way for the purveyors of such stories to get more clicks. They have it down to a science, and I don't mean this figuratively. Experts studying this phenomenon noted that the groups generating this content are not interested in politics, but in clicks. And they take advantage of the fact that our society is becoming less still, less skeptical, and more inclined to overreact in the most emotional of ways. I am consistently amazed that social media users will exercise cautious skepticism toward their politicians, and rightfully so, but accept as fact the ramblings of an anonymous Instagram commentator deep in the comment section of a post. I've watched it happen in real time, and it is utterly bewildering. In November of 2019, a single social media post got people to physically show up to protest Putnam County, New York police officers as they confronted an Army veteran during a 7-hour standoff. Why? Because this particular young man went on Instagram, drinking whiskey, and told everyone the police were coming to arrest him because a fellow vet told the cops he owned 30-round capacity rifle magazines, which are illegal in New York. Social media activists quickly rallied to his cause, spreading a story that he was being unconstitutionally targeted for his firearms. His Instagram following jumped to 150,000 followers overnight. More than $10,000 was raised for a quote-unquote legal fund, and his newfound supporters succeeded in causing chaos within the 911 dispatch system with hundreds of calls. It is hard to imagine a more emotional and real reaction to a situation in which the only evidence came from an intoxicated Instagram user. And the kicker? It was all a farce. The police were arresting him because he had multiple warrants: burglary, aggravated harassment, and larceny, to name a few. And deputies reported hearing what sounded like a gunshot from the man's home. It had nothing to do with firearms or 30-round magazines. But that didn't stop literally thousands of people from engaging in full-on emotional reasoning without an ounce of self-doubt. Less extreme examples can be found on social media daily. The point is this: be still, delay your reaction, be skeptical, and consider alternate possibilities. Hold multiple potential scenarios in your head at the same time. If an argument is wildly passionate, it may indicate that the person is compensating for a lack of substance. Envision yourself as that thoughtful skeptic. Be your own hero, and you will be that person. This applies to personal interactions as well, and the increasing tendency for people to immediately assume hostility, discrimination, or otherwise ill intent from others. We appear to be losing the ability to consider alternate explanations for someone's behavior toward us. For instance, is it right to assume that someone's treatment of you is motivated by some form of discrimination? Or is it possible they treat everyone that way? Maybe they are having a bad day. How many other possibilities are there? And shouldn't we consider those possibilities before assuming they mean us harm? Haidt and Lukianoff discuss this type of problematic us versus them thinking, and how the theory of intersectionality has been corrupted and interpreted to mean a power struggle between the privileged and the oppressed. The theory of intersectionality, originally advanced by UCLA law professor Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, no relation, was intended to eliminate the fact that some individuals may face discrimination along multiple intersecting lines, to include race, class, sex, age, etc. As an analytical tool, this may be useful. The problem is the way it has been used to advance tribalism and moral arguments against the most privileged. In any power struggle, there is a perceived good and bad side, thus pitting us against each other before the conversation has even begun. This form of identity politics, combined with microaggression training, creates, as Haidt and Lukianoff write, an environment highly conducive to the development of a call-out culture, in which students gain prestige for identifying small offenses committed by members of their community and then publicly calling out the offenders. The authors go on to write, "They have learned to interpret mere words and social behaviors as acts of aggression. They have learned to associate aggression, domination, and oppression with privileged groups. They have learned to focus only on perceived impact and to ignore intent." This learned behavior of assuming the worst of intentions has had a chilling effect on freedom of speech and a supremely caustic effect on political discourse. This leads to situations where even innocent gestures are labeled as insidious aggressions by an overreactive media. Take, for example, the Army-Navy football game in December 2019. During this great American tradition, a number of cadets and midshipmen were seen making a peculiar hand gesture behind a sports newscaster, forming a circle with their thumb and index finger. It looked like an upside-down OK symbol. For anyone familiar with military culture, this is known as the circle game. If you are unlucky enough to glance down at the circle, you earn yourself a swift punch to the shoulder. It's a harmless, if somewhat immature, game. But that wasn't the media's take. Within hours, major news organizations pounced, decrying the gesture as a white power symbol and encouraging mass hysteria from social justice warriors across the internet. They claim that the OK sign has been appropriated by white supremacists to mean white power, because a W is formed by three fingers and the P is formed with the index finger and thumb. It led to an actual investigation from actual military personnel into the quote-unquote scandal of the hand gestures. I noted sarcastically on Twitter soon after, "Glad we needed to waste our military's time investigating the hysterical cries of the outrage mob." Why on earth would our first reaction be to imply that a group of future military officers were not so secretly taking part in a racist ideology on national television? What happened to grace and charity, where we interpret the statements of others in the most reasonable possible form? It turns out there is bipartisan agreement on this point. In his 2016 exit interview with NPR, President Barack Obama said he gives his daughters this advice. "Don't go around looking for insults," he tells them. And on the excesses of political correctness, he said, "If you're narrowly defining political correctness as a hypersensitivity that ends up resulting in people not being able to express their opinions at all without someone suggesting they're a victim, our social discourse and our political discourse becomes like walking on eggshells." A mentally weak person reacts to the most offensive potentiality. A still person has the power to simply not know. Which person do you think is happier? Which one do you think has less stress? The person who finds ill intent with every interaction, or the person who chooses to give the benefit of the doubt? To be still is to be much, much happier. Not only that, but you'll be better prepared. Spend some time imagining those bad scenarios, whether it is a bad day on a boogie board or a mean tweet, and then imagine overcoming it. Don't kick yourself later when you finally think of a better response to angry Twitter trolls. Instead, wargame the scenario ahead of time so you have the carefully crafted and far less emotional reaction ready to go. And what if life hits you unexpectedly, in a way you could never anticipate or wargame? When that unfortunate moment comes, and it will, promise yourself that you will encounter it with tenacity, thoughtfulness, self-awareness, and self-control. You will be ready. You will be ready to listen before you react. You will be ready to admit you don't know the answer and seek it out before becoming emotionally attached to a particular argument. You will be unmoved by the haters and trolls because you anticipated them. Hell, you feel sorry for them. Their anger is both foolish and unproductive. Reactive emotional states are useless. You know this now because you live with stillness. Chapter 5, Sweat the Small Stuff. This is the chapter where I give you permission to complain. Permission to moan and groan about the nitty-gritty, small but annoying, ankle-biting inconveniences we face in our everyday lives. Permission to gripe about even your smallest troubles. Grumble about the long lines at the drive-thru and whine about the imperfect weather. I am actually going to encourage it. You're welcome. Okay, don't thank me yet. There are certain ground rules. Number one, sweating the small stuff is okay, but exercise your complaints lightheartedly. Seek out humor in your whining. Be humble. Be self-aware. Number two, if you allow yourself to sweat the small stuff, and I think you should, then you also must force yourself to be detail-oriented. Number three, if you allow yourself to sweat the small stuff, then you must try your hardest not to sweat the big stuff. That's the deal we are making in this chapter. I will declare that it is acceptable to complain every once in a while, and you will agree to do it only with the small stuff and not the big stuff. I am giving this advice because venting is extremely healthy, and it is also good practice for self-awareness. Venting about the little things provides you with perspective on how silly and unproductive complaining really is. At the same time, we should recognize that pent-up frustration can have real consequences and be detrimental to our mental health. I firmly believe that allowing yourself the space to complain every once in a while about the little things frees up mental bandwidth to deal with more consequential life events. It is a frustration release valve. We have all witnessed someone snap. It ain't pretty. It happens suddenly when that one thing just sends them off the edge. Maybe a white shirt got turned pink because it was mixed with a red shirt in the laundry. All hell breaks loose. Detergent is splashed against a wall. The pets go running for cover. Maybe a snide comment by a coworker causes a meltdown in the office. Things are said. Tears are shed. Rumors are spread. It's never about the one comment made or the shirt ruined. It is usually a whole slew of built-up frustrations that just piled on day after day. Your subconscious is a holding tank, filling with stress and frustration from the little stuff we deal with. You know, like when traffic lights in a city grid are not properly synchronized, and you just keep going from one red light to another, and you wonder why city planners can't synchronize the damn green lights to improve traffic flow. Why? Eventually, that tank hits capacity, and that frustration makes its debut in the conscious mind, manifesting in a human firework display of flipping the fuck out. You do not want to be that person who is known to flip out. That should not be included on your hero attributes list. Most advice you get on this subject is just the opposite of what I am telling you. Don't sweat the small stuff, they say. Just be bigger than that jerk on the highway who cut you off before the exit you needed. Smile when the power goes out. Don't cry over spilled milk, and so on. I disagree. Let it loose, my friend, because let's be honest, that little stuff probably still genuinely pisses you off. You can't actually change your emotional reaction to it. So in reality, saying, don't sweat the small stuff, is actually a suggestion to pen it up, or in the words of my last chapter, be still. There's some good reason for this. It is generally socially unacceptable to be seen as the person getting bent out of shape because their steak arrived slightly overcooked. It seems petty because it is. You're probably thinking, okay, Dan, you just got done telling me that I should be still, stop, think, listen, question, when confronted with the bullshit occurrences in life. Aren't you now telling me the opposite? Not exactly. Remember, we have a deal. You can complain about the small stuff, but it should be lighthearted, quippy, and avoid personal attacks. Being still is about having the ability to delay an emotional reaction and replace it with a pre-planned response. The response is intentional and deliberate, not reactionary, and based on the qualities and attributes that you have already aspired to as part of your hero archetypes. You are choosing to sweat the small stuff, but you are choosing to do so with some grace, humor, and self-awareness. This isn't easy. It can go wrong. It may take practice and keen observation of how people react to you, but don't overthink it. Just remember a few key principles. Number one, incorporate humor and sarcasm when possible. Sarcasm is a uniquely American and British attribute, and I think we should embrace it. Number two, smile. Number three, Don't overdo it. Just sweat the small stuff enough to make sure the frustration valve is released a little bit. This is how we sweat the small stuff. It's an art, really. I am personally not sure I have mastered it. My wife thinks I complain too much, but I feel right at home among my fellow SEALs. You'd be amazed how much we complain about the small stuff. Overall, I think our culture has healthily embraced sarcastic, dry humor as a coping mechanism. Our comedy culture largely relies on it. Tony Stark, taking a break with fellow Avengers in between battling mortal enemies, abruptly complains, "Who put coffee grounds in the sink? Who does that?" Comic relief, a lighthearted quip that relieves the tension during a tense situation, is more than just a film technique. It's a life lesson. Remember, your whole life is a tense situation. Scriptwriters are intuitively picking up on this very human need to relieve stress with humor. Sweating the small stuff is about doing just that. Stand-up comedy routines are often a litany of complaints about life and society that are framed in a way that is both relatable and funny. Every parent, for example, can relate to Jim Gaffigan's riff on what it's like with multiple kids. Imagine you're drowning, then someone hands you a baby. I fear we are in danger of losing this ability to laugh off the small stuff, and we are even closer to losing the ability to laugh at the big stuff. Comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock no longer perform on college campuses. Why? The PC culture has driven comedians away. In a 2015 interview, Seinfeld observed, "They just want to use these words. That's racist, that's sexist, that's prejudice," he said. "They don't know what the hell they're talking about." Comedians are worried that they'll offend an overly sensitive generation of students looking for any reason to be offended. This is deeply unfortunate, and not just for the sake of comedy. It is unfortunate because it robs us of our most fundamental pressure release valve, humor. The basic truth is that we, humans, like to laugh. And oftentimes, eliciting that laughter requires some sort of shock factor, inappropriate comment, or politically incorrect observation. For the same reason that I am telling you to sweat the small stuff, I am also telling you that we can't lose our sense of humor. The alternative is a stuffy, emotionally bottled up society walking on proverbial eggshells. Sounds a little bit like hell. So be funny. Watch some shocking comedians. Screw it. Take some risk. See if it offends you. And if it does, start this book over. When working in teams, whether in the office or the military or sports, I find this comedy useful as it pertains to criticizing our coworkers or teammates. As a general leadership rule, you want to punish in private and praise in public. Good leaders build their subordinates up, but also correct them when they're wrong. Corrections are best done in private because good leaders don't seek to humiliate or embarrass their people. There is a small caveat to this law. Sometimes it is okay, and even called for, to punish in public, but in moderation and with a specific intent in mind. There can be value in it, and you do it by sweating the small stuff. In my experience, being in thick-skinned Navy SEAL platoons, we call guys out for both the small and the big stuff. Public shaming is useful for us. That doesn't mean it is useful for all organizations or groups. Not everyone is desensitized to public critique, and I'm not sure we can expect people to be. However, I do believe that there is a certain degree of bonding that occurs when good-natured call-out culture thrives. Again, it's a pressure release valve. I went from the SEAL teams to graduate school to the United States Congress. Graduate school was useful in the sense that I was able to observe academia's gentle nature of civilian-human interactions after having come from the far more direct, rough-and-tumble nature of the military. It was eye-opening, no pun intended. Joking in tense or awkward situations is a necessity on the SEAL teams. In the university system, it can land you in an administrative review or worse. On the teams, we would rip each other for failing to secure some gear properly or forgetting a key piece of kit, often in the full presence of the platoon. In academia, discipline is eschewed and feelings reign supreme. I soon learned that my sense of humor might not work with these people. I evolved. In running my congressional office, I have to take those lessons to heart. In the SEAL teams, it was perfectly normal to open a discussion with the phrase, "You are fucked up right now, and you need to unfuck yourself." Turns out, I don't hear that phrase very often anymore, and that's okay. It wouldn't be appropriate anyway. There are other ways to get the point across. And I don't need my congressional staff to have skin thick enough to survive combat deployments. But I do want to create an atmosphere that is at once accountable, detail-oriented, and fun. The way we do this in the SEAL teams is by sweating the small stuff. And I carry these lessons over to my congressional office. We pick on each other. I use sarcasm and a smile to point out a minor flaw, like, "Oh, I guess we didn't need to be on time to my event today." I don't pick out truly important aspects of people's work to poke fun at, just the little things. I also encourage my staff to pick on me relentlessly, and they do so with a bit more enthusiasm than I anticipated. This requires careful judgment. For instance, I wouldn't recommend saying, "Oh, I guess you thought this briefing on the next Homeland Security hearing was actually well done." That is less funny and more just being a jerk. This entire philosophy flies in the face of everything you have been taught, I get it. For too long, we have accepted this notion that being relaxed and chill about everything is the right way to be. Don't be a narc. Don't sweat the petty things. Don't enforce certain standards because that would make you petty and uncool. But it isn't self-evident that being relaxed about the small stuff is a virtue. While there is some societal romanticizing of the cool, surfer dude, Big Lebowski-type character, especially for teenagers, it isn't at all clear that this is a good thing. The cool kid in high school who doesn't care about anything may also be the most accepting of bad grades, and consequently, he may have a mediocre future. The dude in The Big Lebowski was far from a productive member of society, and even though his "don't sweat the small stuff" lifestyle was entertaining, it was also an utter mess. Ignoring many of the small problems in life can build up in two ways. It can make you crazy, or it can make your life crazy. Both are bad. We went over how it makes you crazy, because pretending that the little things don't bother you and bottling up your frustrations risks setting off an emotional time bomb. But what if these little things truly don't bother you? What if you really are among the coolest of characters that just chillax and hang loose? Again, it isn't self-evident that this is a virtue. It might be for some people. Some people can ignore all the small things in life, but still be productive members of society. But I think the more likely outcome is that the chillax attitude toward the small things carries over to the bigger, more important aspects of life also. And this can be a problem. For instance, it may be a perfectly good thing to keep your cool over a flat tire or lost dry cleaning, but that devil-may-care attitude is less endearing when you are running your business or trying to complete a project on time. When it comes to performing, you must be engaged and detail-oriented, and being too apathetic with certain behavioral habits can chip away at that necessary intensity and focus. It becomes more and more difficult to switch it on when you need it. Details matter. Ignoring them can be the difference between success and failure. We had a deal, remember? If you're going to sweat the small stuff, then you must also seek balance. You must agree to engage in productive, detail-oriented behavior to offset your newfound love of complaining about the small details of everyday life. You have no right to complain about your coffee order being screwed up if you can't even clean your own room. Attention to detail is a mantra in the SEAL teams that is repeated over and over, for good reason. Details matter in life and death situations. If your parachute cord was misfolded or wrapped slightly incorrectly around a riser, well then, your parachute malfunctions. You die. If you make one misstep in your procedure when diving, you become hypoxic. You die. If you don't program your radio correctly, you can't communicate when it really matters. You die. In combat, attention to detail is the barrier between life and death. We generally don't like death, so we pay attention to details. We also don't like failure. We don't like failing in our mission, and we don't like failing the people who are relying on us. Ignoring the small stuff leads to both of those unenviable failures. You may be thinking, this life and death talk is a little extreme. I don't have to go into combat. True, but you take more risks than you are giving yourself credit for. You drive, for instance. You get into a vehicle and fly down the highway way too fast and barely look in the side view mirror before you change lanes. Pretty risky, but hey, party on, you rebel. Even in that somewhat irresponsible moment, you are paying attention to details, especially if you just started driving. So is everyone else around you. Thank God, because you're a jerk driver. The fact that everyone has an unspoken agreement to pay attention to the details of driving is what allows all to travel exceedingly fast down the highway in an organized pile of sharp metal and glass and rubber. This mutual understanding is important, and it is representative of a broader truth, that we must pull our own weight in order to live together peacefully and properly. Once somebody starts to think that cutting the line is okay, society unravels. It is just that simple. The rule of law and societal norms matter, and paying attention to details, even selfishly for your own success, is part of that social contract. You ever wonder why we are always doing inspections in the military? Why do we obsess over perfect creases, shiny shoes, and crisply made beds? It's simple. If you can't get the small stuff right, you won't get the big stuff right. If you ignore the relatively unimportant details, then you are more likely to ignore the very important details, the stuff that actually counts. This is true of running a town, a city, or a country, but also for running your own life. We start our 2-mile ocean swims in Buds with all of our gear perfectly prepared. Our underwater demolition teams, or UDT, life-saving vests, have their valves scraped of all rust, and they are evenly oiled with CLP, a special lubricant used to protect weapons and key pieces of kit. Your name is stenciled clearly with white paint marker, exactly where it should be on each piece of gear. Your dive knife is especially well cared for, being the most thoroughly inspected item. It is not only clean, without a hint of rust, but also sharp enough to shave the hair off your arm. Only then are you approved to enter Davy Jones' locker and start your 2-mile battle against time and sea. All in all, the 2-mile ocean swim conducted once a week during Buds is a fairly low-demand evolution with respect to details, high demand with respect to effort, however. Your detail-oriented requirements essentially amount to a very obsessive-compulsive gear inspection. If the paint stencil isn't bright enough, you fail. Drop down and do push-ups until we feel like telling you to stop, which is not ideal when you have to swim a fast 2 miles immediately after. If the chest strap on your UDT vest isn't tucked correctly, fail. Even the inflation valve lever has to be in a certain position for inspection, or you fail. The truth is that none of this matters, at least not in the way you think. If your knife has a bit of rust, it will still work. If your stencil is faded, it won't affect your ability to swim 2 miles. But the point is not that these details matter for this particular swim. The point is that these details matter because they are details. These small, relatively insignificant details that we start with in the early days of Buds are merely the foundation. They're the first and most important lesson in our obsessive attention to detail mantra. If you can't get the small details right, there is no reason to think you can be trained to get the more important details right. SEALs like to find out early on if you have what it takes. Because here's the thing. That simple 2-mile swim gets a lot less simple later on in training, and unbelievably complex in a real-world operation. The next stage of training is dive phase, where we add navigation tools, like a compass and a stopwatch, nothing fancy. Weights and a closed-circuit, bubble-less Draeger dive rig with a whole variety of additional complexities. The next stage is diving with weapons and other pieces of gear. How do you keep them dry? What mix of water and gun oil do you need to bring to keep the weapon functioning? How do you keep it neutral underwater? Next comes a radio with waterproof headsets. After all, the whole point of being able to swim for 2 miles is so that we can use the water as an infiltration route onto land or a ship. Unless we are conducting underwater demolitions, the water is always just an infill-exfill route. It's never the final destination. This means we need all our equipment with us when we start that swim or dive. the details start to get a lot more complex than just a knife and a UDT vest. And that isn't even close to the end of it. Now imagine a real-world scenario. The planning considerations become immense. You must think of contingencies, medical evacuation plans for both the water infiltration and when you reach your land-based objective. What kind of assets will you have to communicate with? Drones? C-130s? A submarine? And what kind of radios do you need to bring to do that? What about backups? If you're taking over a ship in the middle of the ocean, who is going to drive it once we detain the crew and captain? All that is barely scratching the surface. I don't think this is unrelatable. Anyone who has run a small business, done payroll, or led a complex project can relate to this. Details matter. They are foundations for success, and cutting corners early on in the learning process builds bad habits that are hard to break, making success all that much more elusive. In the SEAL teams, we are brutally unforgiving about attention to details during our training so that we forge that mentality into our men's psyches. It is life or death, so we must. The civilian world isn't quite life or death, but it is certainly about your life. And if you choose to make the best of the one life you have, getting in the habit of paying attention to details is a good place to start. There is also a real psychological benefit to a detail-oriented mindset. In addition to maintenance of an even temperament, there is evidence that deliberate attention to detail yields long-term benefits in pattern recognition and informational synthesis. In short, you may not be smarter, but you'll look it because you'll be faster when new information and systems present themselves in your life. But this book is about mental toughness and battling outrage culture. So how does being detail-oriented really fit in? Well, first of all, if something makes you better at life, I will also suggest that it makes you more mentally resilient. But more than that, if your goal is to be less triggered, less outraged, and less prone to emotional overreaction, then a detail-oriented approach is beneficial. This is because you are more likely to ask questions, be curious, and be measured. A person who is concerned with detail is more likely to ask about context and intent and make counterarguments when confronted with a potentially inflammatory idea or comment. A detail-oriented person is a deeper person, concerned with that next layer of meaning on any given subject. They seek perspective and historical context. They want details. Bogging yourself down in the details on any given subject, especially policy or politically related, is guaranteed to make you less outraged and less extreme. It is the inevitable consequence of adding more context, and it's a good thing. Let me give you some examples. The minimum wage has long been debated. The argument in favor of raising it is deceivingly simple. We want workers to have more money, so we enact laws that force businesses to pay their employees more. So simple. Not only that, but it's a policy that affords lawmakers a sense of moral justice. We are fighting for the little guy and doing the right thing. But the reality is far from simple. There are consequences, second and third order effects, to every action that exists beneath the warm, fuzzy, feel-good layer of being helpful to low-income earners. A mentally tough individual is someone who pushes back on the simplistic instinct to do what feels good, feels morally righteous, and instead questions the details. Passion and knowledge can have an inverse relationship. Details are a natural moderator of strong opinions. The details surrounding the minimum wage debate get quite tricky. First, the economics become problematic. According to a 2019 Congressional Budget Office study, a federal minimum wage increase to $15 an hour could cost up to 3.7 million jobs. Why? Well, for starters, just because we change the minimum wage doesn't change the overall budget a business has for its salaried workforce. The first workers they will cut will be the least skilled. At best, they will cut their hours. And this is exactly what we see in cities that have gone to a $15 minimum wage, like New York City, San Francisco, and Seattle. It also isn't true that people earning minimum wage are the main breadwinners of their family. Half are under 25. About 40% of low-wage workers come from a household that earns three times the poverty rate, meaning these are usually young workers getting their first job and adding income to their household. These are the people being priced out of the job market. The result is that the minimum wage hurts the people we are trying to help the most, because it pushes companies like McDonald's toward automation and prices entry-level workers out of their first jobs. When a hardware store owner is forced to increase her payroll expense by 15 to 20%, the owner has a choice. She can cut jobs or increase prices. Both are bad for the low-income earner. We also are pricing people out who are simply trying to work part-time to add money to their household's overall income. Even worse, overall product prices go up in businesses that use a lot of minimum wage workers, like grocery stores and fast food chains. Whom does this harm the most? The poor. If that weren't bad enough, there is a second problem with the minimum wage. It should never be federal policy. Why? Because different states and different cities have totally different costs of living. You can't pretend that the minimum wage in San Francisco, where rent is on average $3,600 per month, should be the same as in Lubbock, Texas, where the average rent is $693 a month. My point isn't to make the argument against the federal minimum wage, although I do make a good one, but to hopefully stop and make you think less extremely about the debate surrounding a minimum wage. When faced with strong arguments, I would hope that you would be less inclined to become radically opinionated about this particular issue. By way of illustration, I think it is safe to assume that anyone angrily waving a $15 minimum wage sign has never seriously studied these details and internalized them. They willfully embrace the outrage that stems from a shallow and simplistic reading of the problem. A shallow reading of a problem begets outrage. A detailed approach to a problem encourages moderation. That's a common policy example, and I assure you that most policy deep dives will moderate your thinking or maybe even change your mind. Here's another example, where an initially shocking announcement turns out to be rather mild in nature upon learning the details and context. Imagine a hypothetical local government announcement about an elementary school. You hear from the city council that they are canceling plans to refurbish the cafeteria and older West Wing. That's the headline. Seems absolutely senseless at first. You're pissed. You post a strongly worded Facebook message. But then, more details emerge. The plans weren't finalized in time to make it into the final budget. The city just voted last year to raise $500 million in bonds for local schools and infrastructure, and this project wasn't included by that time, probably because the repairs needed were mild compared to the other projects the city needed to prioritize. City officials debated it for weeks. Experts were brought in. Careful consideration took place. Yet, you believed you had the answer when you posted on Facebook. You were so sure of yourself because you read the headline. Has this ever happened to you? I'd be lying if I said I have never reacted that way. We all have. I encounter people with this kind of emotionally driven, self-assured opinion all the time. Forming an opinion without the relevant facts is a phenomenon that I believe is getting worse, probably because of social media and the echo chamber of disinformation it can create. Our tendency to react wildly to headlines, which are already largely crafted to elicit emotional responses rather than inform the public, is asphyxiating the deliberative system of government designed by our founders. It has created a troubling new reality where even new or more complete sets of facts cannot sway opinions. I'm not saying you have to change your opinion, but you should at least have a serious, honest, and coherent reason for why not. Reactive dismissal of new information is indicative of mental weakness. Absorbing new information honestly, even if you don't ultimately change your mind, is a sign of fortitude. The last part of this lesson is the most important. Sweat the small stuff so you can deal with the big stuff. This is the heart of the message, and the most relevant sweat the small stuff lesson as it pertains to the theme of the book, which is mental toughness. Sweating the small stuff is your pressure release valve. It's like that built-in drain at the top of your sink or tub that lets water out before it overflows. That drain is your conscious self, bitching and moaning about the dumb stuff so that your unconscious emotions don't overflow. This shouldn't be news to anyone. It is, after all, why most people see a therapist. They just need to get some issues off their chest. It's why you go to happy hour after work, to blow off some steam and complain about your boss and coworkers. This is healthy behavior, and it should be encouraged. SEALs are not trained stoics. We are human. We complain about the same things that you complain about. We complain about getting wet and cold. We complain about our boss and our command atmosphere. And we complain that our equipment isn't the latest and greatest like it should be. A good leader allows this to happen, to an extent. A good leader understands that part of cultivating a healthy social environment is allowing some complaining. Allowing your team to blow off steam over the small stuff is natural and healthy. Trying to stifle it will not make it go away, just hide it, only to see it boil over later on when you least want it to. A good leader even partakes in some of the complaints, but they are careful how they go about it. It is one thing to complain about the bitter coffee and stale food, but quite another to make substantive complaints about the chain of command in front of your team. Big difference, in fact. One complaint is sweating the small stuff, and the other is fostering true discontent with the institution itself. A favorite memory of many veterans is their time sitting around grumbling incessantly about their circumstances with their teammates. I have to admit that we do this way more than the average group of people. It's like a continuous group therapy project. When the guys stop complaining, leadership starts to worry. What's wrong with them? Are they depressed? Something wrong at home? The reality is that in these high-performing environments where everyone is a perfectionist and an overachiever, people like to point out deficiencies in the most over-the-top fashion, usually with a side of sarcastic and cutting humor. The good news is that they also aspire to fix those problems. Or maybe we are just a bunch of divas. I don't know. Maybe it's both. The point is that it seems to work. The SEALs are regarded as perhaps the finest fighting force on the planet. The ethos on the teams works both as a mechanism to be aware of smaller deficiencies and blow off some steam. Both of these things are important. The SEAL's terror of wet socks. Yes, I said wet.